Welcome back to the Dear Katie podcast. This is Katie Kestner. And as we continue through our healing journey, please always know at the top of every episode, it's really important to me that you all listen with good self-care. Know that this message can be very challenging, very hard to hear. We cover a lot of sensitive emotional issues and are navigating as carefully and thoughtfully as we can through them. Today, our episode, I will be moderating, and I am so entirely honored to have both Greg and Marcel. And as I always do, I like to just say first names and let our guests introduce themselves. So first, I'll turn it to Greg. Who are you? And tell us a little snapshot of your bio.
Yeah. Hi, Katie. Thanks for having me on. I've really appreciated kind of following a little bit of your story. And I am always appreciative of people who kind of use their platform to give a voice to people that might be feeling voiceless. So before I talk about myself, I just kind of wanted to express my appreciation for you and the work that you've done and the gratitude that I feel for being a part of this. So my name's Greg. I'm 35 years old. I live in a little small town here in Montana, and I've been here for I'm coming up on 11 years here in Montana. Prior to that, I grew up and went to school in the suburbs of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Went to undergrad at Temple University there in Philly. And pretty much the day after I graduated, I moved to Alaska. Bumbled around Alaska. I was working for trail crews. I was a kayak guide briefly before I got hooked up with like a wilderness therapy company. And we'll probably get into this later, but that kind of laid the foundation for the trajectory of my career. Spent a few years in Alaska before moving down to Missoula. Lived a short career as a grant writer, doing advocacy work, and just kind of figuring myself out through my early 20s and late 20s before ultimately deciding to go back to grad school. Went to University of Montana in Missoula, where I studied clinical mental health counseling. And currently, I am a therapist. I have my own private practice here in Helena, Montana, where predominantly my mission is just to clean up my little corner of the world and kind of help people work through whatever they're trying to work through.
Thank you. Like, I'm already going globetrotting with you from Philly back to Alaska to Montana. Sounds great. Well, we are also, we'll come back to you, what brings you to your mic, Greg. But Marcel, welcome to the podcast. And you don't have to, you know, globetrot for the sake of globetrotting, but where have you been in life so far?
Yeah, thank you so much, Katie. I have to echo Greg and appropriately thank you for allowing me to be a part of this show. Also, thank you for sharing your story and this platform with us today. Thank you. I have to say that appropriately. I am Marcel Anderson, who is considered to be a soul survivor, soul singer, heart singer, heart survivor, one who loves to motivate, love to inspire, love to create, because I come from a creator who have created things beyond what I see. So I live through faith. I live through things that oftentimes don't see and disbelieve. I'm a soul believer through life that helps me to navigate things that I do as a human being. And I'm grateful to just to be alive today, to have been born and raised in Spartanburg, South Carolina. I am a twin, and I have two older twin brothers, and also I can never leave out my sisters, three sisters. So I was born in a family, big family, a household.
Can I just push pause? I want to hear that again. You are a twin, and you have two other twins. Your mom made two sets of twins.
Two sets of twin boys.
That's amazing. I just have to speak to that because I'm also the mom of, I made two twin boys too. I'd love to meet your mom someday, I'm sure. No, it's quite a thing to be a twin, I'm sure, and the mom of twins. But keep going, Marcel. Oh my goodness. I love what you were saying about your faith journey, and we left off there.
Yeah, we are brought up in a family of faith and inspiration and in a musical family, what leads me to a professional musician for the last 8 years, providing professional music through the lens of my voice. My voice is my instrument. not only do speaking, but also as a professional vocalist. I've been doing that for the last 8 years, paid, not worried about anything else. That's what I do to inspire and motivate other people to believe in themselves, believe in their dreams, to believe in their purpose, which allowed me to lean on my faith when I've gone through things that I didn't think I would be able to survive. We'll share more about how I was able to navigate through some very tough times in my life because of my faith and because of my instrument.
Well, already, gentlemen, I am so honored to have both of you on the show, but I'm already thinking what we can accomplish in part one today. We then need to divide and conquer with part two for each of you, if you're amenable and open to it, to hear more. So maybe what we try to accomplish in episode number one with the two of you together is kind of what I think is interesting. First and foremost, is you two are vastly different men in where you grew up, how you grew up, the skin you wear, the faith, the belief. Like, you're very different, but you're the same age. I think within a year or two. Marcel, are you, how old are you? 38?
38, yes.
Yeah, and didn't you say, Greg, you're 37?
No, sorry. I just turned 35 last week, in fact.
Oh, well, I will say you're close. You're two men, you're in the same kind of high school cohort, right? The 4 year. And I'm coming at this as a white hetero woman from age 50, but I love thinking together today as we do this first part about what happened to each of you and give historic narrative, because the one thing I want to start out the podcast with is when I was 18 years old and that whole Time magazine and what happened, I was so adamant about the definition of rape itself needed to be changed back in 1990 because it was based on property rights over women. Women were property, sexual property of men. And so I don't know if our listeners nor, both of you, you probably may know this, but I read those laws at a non-legal 18-year-old kid, first year of college. I went through something and then I was like, what pertains to what happened to me that could possibly make it wrong? And so when I read those laws back then, it was all based on force and all the pronouns were she, victim. So I wanted to preface our whole conversation today with what the one maybe good thing I did was I helped change. I said the law shouldn't be based on force and resistance, number one. And number two, anyone should be able, any gender, any identity should be able to say that this was wrong and it happened to me and we can call this thing rape, sexual assault, sexual abuse, sexual violence. And so one of the most important things I've been working on now globally, but I helped change it domestically here in the US, was making all the pronouns gone. But believe it or not, you guys, it took, because rape is a state level law. It's not a federally protected thing. Every single state can define rape differently. And some of the last states to change to be gender neutral were, unfortunately, Marcel, you said South Carolina. There's also Mississippi, Alabama. I hate to say it, that are deep south and, Midwestern. But every state has now finally changed. And I'm thinking about how long ago it was that the laws became gender inclusive. And I think the last state to change was about 15 years ago, which, is so interesting to me to think about our journey and our talk tonight. The other thing I just wanted to tell both of you about is globally, I just did an international conference with Nigeria, and Nigeria's laws are still based on only women can be raped. So if you two have any inspiration from our conversation over today or the next time we talk, like the work that I started 32 years ago to make things different and gender inclusive still has to be done globally too. So that set aside, I wanted to give historic context to the whole conversation for our listeners and for both of you and just honor you as men, because I'm only thinking, like, would I as a man have felt like I could even speak up about what happened to me. So I thought that could be part of what we talk about today. So if that makes sense, let's, Marcel, I might have cut you off. Was there anything else about your bio and where you are that you want to add before we go back to what brings the story that brings us to our mic?
Yes, I currently live in Raleigh, North Carolina. I was just born and raised in South Carolina. So I currently reside in Raleigh, North Carolina, where I came to Raleigh on a track scholarship. And I came here to attend St. Augustine's University, received a undergrad degree in psychology, and I went to receive a license in special ed. I taught high school for about 6 years, special education. Ended up going to seminary to receive a license in leadership ministry, and then went to receive a master's degree in human behavior. Currently, always learning in various capacities outside of the schoolhouse. So I'm not sure how much more schooling I would move.
That sounds like a lot of schooling, Marcel.
I tell you, but you know, I'm grateful because currently I'm able to impact the lives of young men, African-American young men. That is, I run a nonprofit males mentoring program called Accelerating Men. Outside of traveling and singing, I focus my efforts in impacting the lives of African-American young men ages 10 through 18. And we are a faith-based mentoring program. We're not a church, we're not a religion. We focus on the spiritual identity of our young men, helping them to understand that they have something beyond themselves that helps them to move, that drives them to move. Without that spiritual component, it's difficult for them to develop appropriately, to develop holistically. It is the heartbeat of who they are and who we are as a people and what we believe.
That's so beautiful, Marcel. I can't wait to have all of our listeners dive in more. And we'll be sure to get, you know, some websites or other ways to learn more about your work for sure. But let's talk about the hard part, the story, the experience that brings us to our microphone. How about we go back to Greg? What did that look like to you? What happened? Whatever you feel comfortable sharing.
Yeah, my story kind of begins as a young boy. I grew up in suburban Philadelphia, kind of as I alluded to before. Lived a pretty traditional life, going to school, playing sports, having friends, and always had to go home to a difficult family situation wherein dad worked a lot, he wasn't home as often as I would have liked. I had two older sisters. My sisters were both significantly older than me. They were like 9 and 11 years older than me. So there was always a large age gap between me and my sisters. And I always feel like I was raised as more of an only child than as a young boy with older sisters. And unfortunately, I had a sister who struggled mightily with her own mental health, and that garnered a lot of attention from my parents. I think it dominated a lot of our family system and how they parented. A lot of eyes were on, this is such a trope, but like the middle sibling. And I always felt like that I was kind of lost in the shuffle. So even though I was living like a pretty privileged life, I still felt like I wasn't seen. And when you don't feel seen, you tend to get lost. And that's what happened for me. So every day I would ride the bus home. And over time, what I now understand is I was groomed by an older boy that was a couple grades ahead of me. And instead of going home, he would invite me over to his house.
So, Greg, what I was hearing you say is like you had two older sisters. They were a lot older, 9 and 11. You had kind of an absentee father situation and you felt lost. And so there was a boy on a bus. Who was this boy and about how old were you? And then what happened?
Yeah, so this boy was a couple of years older than me. To my best recollection, as trauma tends to do, it makes memories hard. Our brains are really good at protecting us from painful memories. So it's hard for me to always surmise exactly when this began and even how long it went on. By my best guess, it was like 4 to 5 years of me riding the bus with an older boy. He kind of understood my situation at home and would kind of offer a respite in his home. And as a young boy, like, you're just looking for a space to avoid the tumult that's going on in your own home. So you say yes to everything.
And this tumult, just so we know what you were avoiding, was it sexual abuse? What was the tumult going on in your best description?
No, there was no physical or sexual abuse going on in my home. There was a lot of fighting due to my own sister's mental health and kind of my parents' differing views about how to best support my sister.
Okay. So now you're at this boy's house most days of the week after school.
Yeah, most days of the week it felt more comfortable to get off the bus a couple bus stops earlier than I should have. And what started out as like, hey, let's go jump on the trampoline or let's go swim in the pool, quickly turned into let's go into the basement. And this was at the kind of the precipice of AOL Instant Messenger and the internet and all of the technology that we now use every single day. This was me getting introduced not only to the internet, but also the dark side of the internet, pornography. And this boy, at the time I was in elementary school, he was probably in late middle school, began showing me pornography, introducing me to the idea of homosexual sex. And yeah, now as an adult, I understand I was being groomed. The abuse started months into us being on that same school bus together. And again, I'll reiterate, my memories around this are kind of dark and fuzzy, hard for me to access. But I remember the first day very explicitly. He suggested that we take off our clothes and rub our private parts together. Really, my first introduction to me being like a sexual object to another person in any way, which, as you can imagine, as a 8 or 9 year old, that pretty quickly strips all sense of control or safety that you feel like you have over your life. I continued to make the choice to go to that boy's house over going to my own home. Even as I sit here now, I'm not sure why I made the choice, like why that felt safer than going home.
Let's do this. I have an idea, Greg. I think it's really important to give you the space to reflect on what you've said so far. And I wrote down a bunch of questions, and our listeners may have some as well. But maybe if we can give pause to where you were at this period and what you'd been through. The only quick question I have is, you were choosing this type of abuse over going home because I can only imagine at your age weighing out the options, and it felt a little safer to do one over the other. And then how long did this, so you're 8 or 9, the best memory we have, and how long are you continuing with this part of your experience?
Yeah, I think the best way I can rationalize it now is I was making the choice between being seen, feeling like I had some value to contribute, versus getting lost in the shuffle, not feeling like I was an active participant in my family, even though as a 8 or 9 year old, I felt like what was happening was wrong and bad. At least I was like doing something or serving some purpose. And at home, I just kind of felt like a fly on the wall and that nobody was really seeing me because all eyes were on somebody else.
And just to wrap this up before we hear from Marcel, not wrap it up, but just like give one, I was just thinking we need to like give some bookend to it. So this was, you know, you're 8 or 9, and it lasted until you were, what's your best guess? And it wasn't the same boy. And you said he was older, but was he 12? Was he 15?
Yeah, so at the time it started, he was probably 12, 13. And by the end of it, he was probably approaching high school. I was approaching middle school or junior high.
Yeah, gotcha. Okay, so it went on for years. This boy grew up kind of learning how to do this. So let's push pause on this part for a moment, Greg, because now I'm realizing there's so much depth and breadth to both of your stories. And Marcel, we have not even really learned, except you were, I was singing along with you and your musical career now that you're at this stage of your healing journey. But I would love to share what also happened in your life, you know, to bring you to this point. So let's switch from Greg over to Marcel. So Marcel, tell us more about you and your journey.
Yes. Almost 11 years ago, or 12 years ago, the age of 26, my story comes from me being an adult male. And as I mentioned earlier, as an educator for 6 years, I was teaching high school. And during this time, I was helping a coworker move into their house. And as we entered into the house, we was beginning to disassemble items within the house, and immediately someone came out of the closet and held a gunpoint and began to shove me in the back room and handcuff me, blindfolded me, and also had a pole in the other hand. And the words were, if you do everything I tell you to do, you may live. So already mentally, do I try to get out of here? Do I try to resist? Do I try to, take care of myself and my coworker? I just surrendered to the instructions of this individual who I did not know and still do not know who it was to this day, and began to shove me into another room and lay me face down and began to brutalize me with the pole, as I mentioned, and the gun, kicked me in the back with his foot. And began to hit me with the pole, was gashes in my head, began to bleed in my head and my eye. The gun was dropped, but it did not go off. It hit me in my head. And when I thought things could not get any worse after him calling me out of my name and asking me, what am I doing here? He began to pull down my pants and he told me to open up my legs, and the pole he stuck on my anal about maybe 20 something times. I don't remember how many times. People always ask, how do you know how many times? I just know it felt like it happened forever, right? But in this first time, when he put the pole up my anal, I didn't think, he would do it again. And he did it again to the point where I could actually hear things internally move around. And if he did it again, probably would have blacked out, but I held on strong. I don't know how. It was from my faith. That's how I held on. It's my faith. Let me go back there. That allowed me to hold on. And during that time, I was probably at home probation for about an hour plus, and I was able to walk out alive. I was able to get to my place of residence. Both me and my coworker, we ended up going our separate ways because I was telling them that I needed to get to a place, comfort or the hospital. And I ended up walking to a nearby store. Now, keep in mind, all that what happened to me had taken place internally, and got to a nearby store, called the ambulance, and was rushed to the hospital. And by that time, my stomach had blowed up like I was pregnant, and went into immediate surgery for about 8 plus hours, and ended up waking up from a surgery I did not know I was having, and had tubes out my body. I ended up living with a colostomy bag for about 4 months, tubes coming out of my body, and hospitalized, I think the first time, for about 6 weeks, just due to the trauma, the traumatic experience that I went through, being sodomized, right, with a pole. And I did not know that something like this could happen to anyone. This is the only time that I've ever been sexually assaulted, not only by someone, but by an object, right? This was an object that went up to in my anal. So something that I never thought would happen to me, yet alone just take place at all. But after, you know, being in a hospital for 6 months, I was able to walk away, go back home, and just trying to regroup and recover. And 4 months later, I was able to have my colostomy bag reversed. So I don't live with that anymore. And, you know, during that time, it was very difficult as a male in his adulthood, people asking questions, trying to understand what happened. It got to the point to where I stopped talking about it and started writing about it. So I ended up writing a book, my first book called Still Living, A Victimized Man's Journey on Purpose to Live, where people can learn more about the full story and understand, you know, the details of it. Like today, I'm giving you details and overview, but really in the book, I really go on a deeper dive in about 10 chapters and navigate through what it means to still be alive, what it's still to be a victimized man's journey. But I'm purposed to live. The fact that I'm still here today talking to you as a sexual assault male survivor, I have meaning. That we have meaning as something that's waiting for me still, right? That's not by happenstance that I'm still able to talk through this. But even in the difficulties of what I experienced, I had to plug into different outlets and resources, which one is a spiritual counselor, two, a professional counselor, and three, myself. I had to really consult with a spiritual counselor, professional counselor, and myself to allow myself to know that it's okay and that I'm going to be okay no matter what I went through. So in a very short overview, that is my survivor's story.
Marcel, thank you. Oh my gosh. Yeah, Greg, you were going to say something too. Go ahead, Greg.
Yeah, I was just going to say thank you for sharing that. Like, I think that kind of the connection point for all of us is, sorry.
No, it's okay. That was a lot, Greg. Yeah, it was a lot.
I'm really moved by what you're sharing and proud of you that you're kind of standing where you are today.
Thank you, Greg.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, Marcel, you are a brave human and also so visionary with, you know, I'm just thinking how I definitely want to talk with both of you on more episodes. But since we're together today for this one, maybe where we could go next is the two of you just talk about the symbiotic or relative factors between the two of you. Like, if we have the generous time that I can talk with each of you separately, I think what's valuable and helpful for us today on this episode is for us to think about, you know, you both shared incredibly heart-wrenching, brain-wrenching, emotionally draining stories of what you both went through. I think it would be so valuable for the three of us to talk as three survivors about how we processed each of our stories, maybe. I've not done that on the podcast, but I think that might be really interesting and helpful about when survivors hear each other's survivor stories and how we process them and sit with them and think with a survivor as, you know, how can we best empower and learn and support our story. All three of our stories are unique unto ourselves, you know, but what ties us together are so many important threads. So maybe Greg or Marcel, either of you.
I have a jumping off point, Katie. And I think for me, so Marcel, our stories are different in that yours happened much more recently in your life than mine did. And for me, my abuse stopped about the time I became a teenager. And at that point, I shoved it down. I refused to accept that those things happened to me, that I had been sexually abused. I was very confused about what that meant for me as a man, particularly as a teenager who was just trying to figure out how to be a teenager, let alone a teenager who had just been sexually abused for several years. And my solution to it was to not talk about it. And I found other ways to cope. And my way of coping was I always felt very attuned to any room that I went into. It was like an immediate like threat assessment. Like, this person's safe. This person might be a threat. This person is hurting in the same way that I'm hurting. Like, every social situation, every classroom you step into, you're immediately just kind of assessing where everybody else is at. And the end result of that is like me going home as a teenager, just introspecting and ruminating on all these really hard feelings and difficult thoughts for a 15, 16 year old kid to process. And I didn't feel like I had a person to go home and talk to or share, like, hey, this is what happened to me and this is how it affected me. And to your point at the beginning of the podcast, Katie, like speaking to your story and coming out and sharing what happened to you in the hopes of empowering other people to talk about their own abuse, it wasn't until the Me Too movement, like during the Kavanaugh hearings, that I myself saw myself in the public where I felt empowered enough to the point where I was like, oh, okay, maybe healing is rooted in me sharing my story. So I went through over a decade of silence before I stood up and made the choice, like, I'm going to tell a therapist that this happened to me. I'm going to tell my mom that this happened to me. And it wasn't until I put my story out into the ether that I felt like I was gaining back control over my life.
Marcel, what were your thoughts on what Greg just offered?
Yeah, thank you again, Greg, for sharing your vantage point. Just kind of listening to him, I can agree and relate as relates to being in certain environments and assessing the room. At many parts of my life and post of my situation, I became very guarded, became very protective of me and those trusted people that I thought I could trust in my space, right? When I look at the correlation, this is my thoughts around it, just being caught off guard for me, I've always been more alert, thinking like being caught off guard and experiencing the unexpected. I've always feared being caught off guard again, right? So I became very alert, very guarded, had a wall put up in my life and being very outgoing prior to my episode. Many people were like, oh, you're okay, you've changed. I said, absolutely, I've changed. I've changed for many reasons, for the betterment of my development and the purpose of me protecting myself. That's through, again, spiritual counseling, professional counseling, and really connecting to myself. I was quiet at some point post of my experience, but I became even more vocal for and an advocate for male sexual assault survivors. I would begin to look up, has this happened to anyone else? And one of the ways I came across 1 in 6 in the Briscoe Cone Project and connected with other men who had a shared story, shared experience such as me, and knew that I needed to talk more. I needed to share what not only happened to me, but how do I connect? What is the connector with men who've experienced this, and how do we impact the lives of other men when we look at the statistics of 1 in 6, but we recognize that's just ones who reported, right? And so many more men who could find, right, and can find that more men are sexually assaulted, right, in the cases that are reported versus the cases that are reported. So this understanding that the assessment of being more alert when you're in certain environments and being guarded and people not really getting to know who I am off the gate. I'm more sociable prior to my incident, but now I've been more guarded until I can get to know you. It's going to take a little bit more time than me just easing into a conversation to say, hey, you're my best friend. No, I need to know a lot about you before you come into my convoy. And I feel like I can trust you to be a part of my circle. I'm watching you, even when I'm talking to you, even when you think I trust you, I'm still watching you. it's just inedible to be a part of that space.
Can I say, here's what I'd like us to talk about. Like, we have probably 10, 15 minutes. But what about this idea, the trust factor? How is it unique to men after assault? That's one theme I heard both of you speak to. And the other one maybe we could talk about is, so your two experiences are vastly different. I'd like to hear from Greg and Marcel, each of you, if you can reflect upon what it felt like to listen to a story. Greg, yours kind of a childhood known person in your base versus Marcel, you know, a completely unknown, violent in the physical way, you know, not, you were coerced, but not in the way that Greg was groomed and coerced. And I think the two things I'd like to round out with are, what did it feel like to think about force and coercion for both of you, hearing each of your stories? And then that's my first question. And then my second one is going to be, lastly, you know, how does it feel thinking as we round out toward trust? So maybe we could start with one of you talking about what it means to hear about the various types of coercion, because I preface it this way. In, I think, every society I've ever worked with, encountered, the judgment and ranking of violence is very different. They would look at, Marcel, what you went through, very differently from what Greg went through. And most people would rank them very differently. How are each of you hearing each other's stories? And is there any subconscious ranking that you still have vestiges of? And if so, what does that mean? And maybe where do we go? Because your two experiences are both horrible. However, I think we get judged on the metrics of perceived, could have done better, could have said no, amount of force and violence. I think that would be really helpful to start with. So let's start with that one. And if you're comfortable thinking about and answering it, that's my first one. This is the great thing about being on the podcast together, both of you. Marcel, I turn it back. What are your thoughts on that part?
Prior to entering into the space that I thought was a safe space to help someone have become a dangerous space, and prior to that, I had many thoughts of not going, right? I'm leaning into my faith. I spoke to myself and not knowing that this was going to happen, but the spiritual part of me was lying in something beyond me and said, do not go. One of my best friends at that time was driving me around because my car was in the shop, and he actually dropped me off and he told me, don't go. I don't feel good about what's happening. How often have you ever felt a tug or pull that told you don't do? But I was focused, and I talk about this in my next book, loyalty. I've become loyal to my words, and if I don't do it, then now I'm looked at differently, right? So if I would have went against my loyalty, would I have saved myself, or would I be looked at differently? So in that space, how often can we really listen to that voice beyond ourselves if we believe that we should not go? How do we respond to that voice or that thing that tells us not to go, right? So in that space for me, I was kind of preparing myself for that moment and end up being in a space where now I'm violated. My life has been violated. Now I'm labeled as somebody who's been violated. What does that look like? People are now putting this name attached to me, right? And I'm trying to protect myself. Oftentimes, when they have been sexually assaulted, meaning you have come to me and said, you are living a certain lifestyle, right? Now I have to defend my manhood, and nothing against anyone who experienced this and felt that they have lived in a certain way. But for me personally, based off of shared, oftentimes people associate sexual violence with homosexuality. Oh, you must be, yeah, you must be this, you must be that. So having to live with that, to have to support myself and to let people know that, you know, I'm here to just to navigate through what I've experienced. And anyone who experienced it, whether they're living in a different lifestyle than mine, but we all have a shared vision and we should not have gone through that.
Well said. Thank you so much. I appreciate it, Marcel. Maybe one, what are your thoughts going back to Greg?
Yeah, I think it's hard to put all of our experiences like on a scale and like compare one to another. I think we all hurt and experience healing in similar ways. And like that is what binds us, is we're all hurt. We all believe, to Marcel's point, that what happened to us should not have happened to us. And when I think about like my healing journey, I identify certain people that for whatever reason, I just intuitively felt connected to or more in trusting. And those are the people that lifted me up out of the hurt. Those are the people that empowered me to share my own story. And that's what kind of facilitated my journey of healing, was key people understanding that what happened to me was not my fault, that there's nothing wrong with me, because those were all narratives that I was telling myself, that this must have happened to me because there's something intrinsically wrong with Greg. And when you grow up believing that there's something wrong with you, like that leads to a very unhappy life. But when you can identify a person to lift you out of that, like that's the true definition of a hero. And that's what I'm seeing in all three of us here today, is somewhere along the line, we've all made the choice to become one of those people, right? We've been equipped with a certain amount of empathy to be able to see like, oh, you kind of hurt in a similar way that I hurt. And I don't believe that a human should ever have to go through that. So here's what I'm going to do in my little section of life to try to ensure that that's not going to happen to anybody else. So that's why I'm always proud to participate in stuff like this, to meet people like Marcel, to meet people like Katie, who have taken one of the worst things that humans can go through and choose to use it as a platform to be empowering in some way.
Thank you so much. I want to think about next steps with both of you and honor each of your journeys on our collective discussion. I think in some ways, though, you both dodged the question I just asked, which is fine. And you can totally dodge it. I wanted to delve in as we finish out for today. I don't mean to provoke difference of opinion, but I thought the things you have in common are both of you as heterosexual men, I believe. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think that's your identity. We're assaulted by men. And please correct me if I got that part wrong. But the thing I went to, which is kind of where I started, which was I had to switch, or I felt compelled myself to change the laws of the country to be centered on consent and chosen experience and willingness to participate in an act. Neither of you chose to experience what you did, but the means and types of force or coercion or fear factors were vastly different, including, you know, the circumstances. I've always felt there are so many levels of self-blame as survivors, but societal blame by those around us. And I feel like we could go a lot deeper into that, but for each of you, maybe thinking about what it means to navigate as a survivor, you know, you, Marcel, with this terrifying experience of unforeseen circumstantial sexual abuse, with everyone listening, I'm sure, can say a gun in any scene automatically raises it to a certain level. And then to contrast, but not belittle, nor I would say one is, I always say ranking isms, ranking trauma is always bad. But then going back to you, Greg, you know, you were choosing at a very young age to experience, not choosing abuse, but choosing two options that were in front of you. One was going to, I'll say choosing, going to one place or another place. And you weren't choosing abuse. You were choosing locations where I could be, and there wasn't a gun present. So I kind of like thinking lastly for our listeners also, because all of us sit with so many levels of self-blame and societal blame, right? So what we've achieved in this episode so far is the contrast between both of your experiences. Both of you, though, are already minorities in so many ways, as identifying as male, and then other identities, including, you know, Marcel, you're a Black man. We haven't even talked about that so much, but I just wanted to round out tonight with closing comments from each of you on this kind of concept of ranking. How bad was it? And then how did you process that yourself? So, and then we can think about next
time. Violence is violence, and I don't think you can rank what happened to someone or compare it on any level. Even, you know, when I go speak and share about my story and others, like, man, I haven't been through what you've been through, but you've been through something, and it does not matter. It should not happen to you, right? Violence is violence, no matter how it happened to you. And the fact that this has happened to me, it gives me the opportunity and the platforms to share and advocate to other men, to those who have shared the same experience as I have. And again, navigating through those things and really understanding that even we haven't talked about the mental capacity, the mental challenges, the mental illness that once go through the PTSD, depression, and trying to control themselves from being abnormal, right? Those things, you know, emotionally comes out, and just really getting the help that you need and able to navigate through those things. When we as men are supposed to compress those feelings, those thoughts, we're looked at as we're crazy. No, you should feel that way. Something crazy and bad happened to you. Now, you should feel that way. How do you navigate through that feeling? How do you work through that feeling? Who do you work with when you've gone through something like that? Is it a trusted friend? Is it someone who's licensed, a clinical psychology? There's certain people that are designed to help you navigate through this. Everyone cannot support you when you go through something like this, but someone should support you when you go through any violence or sexual assault, sodomization, whatever it is. You should get some type of support, a resource to help you navigate through that, because it is difficult. It is not easy. It is a process, and it's a journey. It is a continuous developmental process. And if you don't address it, it will address you.
Yeah.
So beautifully said, Marcel. Beautiful. We got it. We can roll back one more time to you, Marcel. But Greg, what are your concluding thoughts?
That's so well said, Marcel. I agree with you on the point of violence is violence, and none of our response to it is wrong. No matter how we hurt, no matter what things happen to us, we as humans, we all have our response to it. And how lucky are we that we have people that are there to catch it, so to speak. Perhaps on another episode, I'd be welcome to talk about kind of the role that masculinity plays in all of this, because I think that's a connecting thread in all of this, is how do we raise boys to become men? For me, I think my perpetrator learned to be a man in really unhealthy ways. There's a lot going on societally that culturally prescribes gender norms onto young men, and they transmute those messages to act out in these really unhealthy ways because they don't have healthy outlets like this to talk about the things that affect them. So that would be something that I'd be welcome to talk about on another episode. I don't want to get too far into it because I realize that that's a really big topic. But as my work as a therapist, that's kind of the world that I live in, is like, how do we raise boys to become men that are loving and nurturing and able to express their emotions? They have an emotional vocabulary. They feel safe being vulnerable. These are all things that play into men acting out on other men. And I think as different and as me and Marcel's stories are, I think there's probably a connecting thread that falls along those lines.
Yeah, Greg, I'll say you said something very key. I know time is of the essence, but there's an organization called Call to Men who was running a campaign. It was a documentary called The Mask You Live In. You may have heard it, or if not, please go review it. Wonderful. And when I saw that and really done some work around that as well, I came up with the acronym with MASK. It kind of correlates with what you discussed and me and being able to be in a safe space to really talk and navigate through the emotions and the things they've been through and not compress them. Making a secret known. How do we help them navigate through their mask, which is making a secret known? Oftentimes they don't want to share certain things that they are not proud of or scared to share. How do we create a space for men, particularly, to be able to know that they're in a safe space and what they do share will be able to help them and not hurt them?
Well said, both of you. My goodness. Let's wrap up with this for tonight. Both of you were amazing. And thank you for your vulnerability, your transparency. You're amazing. I wish we could dialogue faster back and forth from everyone. But, you know, I think we need to set everything on the table for this episode. And then I'll reach back out to both of you and we can think upon where we go from here. But, you know, both of you are incredibly powerful examples of survivorship and success. And I'm so incredibly honored to have you both on the podcast and have your stories shared to help more survivors. So first and foremost, Greg and Marcel, thank you, thank you. Then to all of our listeners, as we always do at the conclusion of every episode, we want you to do reflection, self-care, journaling, whatever you need to keep going, to keep thriving and surviving. Truly, you know, survivorship is unique to each of us, but we are joined with so many levels of how we process and think through the trauma we've been through. And as we learned tonight, you know, trauma is trauma. It doesn't have a gender. It doesn't have a one-time, a multi-time, a weapon, a coercion. Like, it has its impact on all of us collectively. For further self-care, we encourage all of you to visit the Take Back the Night website. Our resource section is replete with lots of ways that you can do your own further reading, further investigation, and further care. So together we thrive, together we survive. So thank you so much. And again, my gratitude both for Greg and Marcel for our episode today. Take care, and we look forward to our next episode.